Today is Giving Hearts Day, a day devoted to nonprofit and charitable giving in our region. And we hope you'll contribute to the many wonderful and worthy organizations doing good work to the benefit of our region. And we hope you'll consider Prairie Public among them. Every day we educate, involve, and inspire the people of the Prairie region. Our goal is to raise $70,000 on Giving Hearts Day, and we have some help thanks to up to $15,000 in matching money from Prairie Public's Board of Directors. Just go to givingheartsday.org, select the red donate button, and search for Prairie Public. And thank you for being a giving heart.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show with Ellen Chafee. She's a board member of North Dakota Voters First, and we're going to talk about redistricting because we've had a census, and every census, every 10 years, legislative boundaries are redistricted, or for that matter, congressional ones. Ellen, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much, Doug. I'm glad to be with you.
What is the mission of North Dakota Voters First?
North Dakota Voters First, in the very most essential terms, is the mission is to strengthen democracy in North Dakota. There are many ways in which we have made changes that did not work in the favor of voters. Our goal is to educate and engage North Dakota citizens in effective actions to make elections and public policy more transparent, ethical, and accountable to the people.
What is the significance of the name?
Well, that's a good question. The voters should be top priority, and citizens should be top priority in the minds of public officials. Versus wealthy special interests, for example, or corporations or others. You know, if public officials had a fiduciary duty, it would be to the people of North Dakota. And over time, maybe not over time, might be just a basic truth in all government that things tend to be skewed by whoever has the time and effort and money to be there or to buy ads or whatever the case might be. And, you know, that's not democracy. We're supposed to have a representative democracy. And if, for example, in this case, if the districts don't represent the voters, then we can't have a representative democracy.
So you're talking about what is often referred to as gerrymandering, sculpting districts so that they favor a particular political party or candidate.
Exactly.
This morning, you attended a House hearing on this issue, House Bill 1397. Can you recap the bill for us and why you were there?
Yes, the bill is exactly the same, except for some dates, as the bill that was passed in 2011. To start the redistricting process here. What they do is set up a committee of legislators that starts meeting after the session because the census data doesn't become available until about then, might be even later this year. And they go through quite a complicated process in trying to come up with districts that meet federal and state criteria. For example, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 has some very specific requirements to ensure that that the rights of minorities are addressed in the districting process. So there's software now. There's very sophisticated software that gets done, and so they meet several times over the summer and into the fall to try different ways of drawing the lines that determine what voters will vote together, basically. And sometimes the person across the street is in a different district than you are. The primary goal, of course, is to have an equal number of people in each district, because then each legislator represents the same number of people. But it turns out to matter quite a lot how you draw the lines. So that bill, our issues with the bill as it turned out last time primarily have to do with making it a very separate and process that doesn't really invite citizen input. And best practices nationally are that there's kind of a if the legislators draw the map, which they do here, but in a decreasing number of states, there's a movement toward independent commissions to draw the maps. But if the legislators are going to draw the maps, then let's have a partnership with the people who know the areas and who have concerns about whether they can conveniently travel throughout the district, whether there are rivers in the way or whatever the case might be. Anyway, it's just best. It's more better democracy to have a partnership in drawing those lines. So that's a big part of what we're looking for. In addition, at the national level, there are some very important criteria for what is a good district. One of them is that it allows communities of interest to be in the same district so that they can have someone who represents their interests or nearly so. I was thinking about, for example, the area out by the national park. That's a whole different place than, let's say, Dickinson or Watford City or any place else. It's a community of interest that revolves around something. So at any rate, it's complicated. It will take several meetings. Last time it took 7 meetings to come to something. And then at the end of the process, the legislature reconvenes and approves whatever map the committee has come up with or doesn't, hopefully approves.
Well, at this point, the community of interest that matters seems to be the supermajority in the legislature. It's heavily weighted Republican, and as I understand, House Bill 1397 would create a redistricting committee that would be weighted 8 or 9 to 1, Republican over Democrat, mm-hmm. in terms of drawing those lines.
That is the plan, and it is a concern. One of the things we are asking as an amendment is that they at least put the word bipartisan in. They've already indicated that it will be bipartisan, but we're hoping that will make them think a little further because, you know, for one thing, an awful lot of people in North Dakota and everywhere are neither Republican nor Democrat. Where is their representation? In addition, we know that that the plan we've had for the last 10 years was specifically publicly designed to favor the Republicans. Al Carlson from Fargo, at that time the House Majority Leader, was quoted in the newspaper as saying, "This is a Republican plan for the next 10 years. There should be 6 new Republican members of the legislature in the next election cycle." So sure enough, so one proposal that we could make to them is they should add 6 more Democrats, or if we had any independents, they could go in there too, because they were able to gain 6 seats just through redistricting the last time around. So, you know, it's natural for people in power to gerrymander if they can, or to basically try to make the rules to favor themselves. This is not a partisan issue. This is not saying that Republicans are bad. It's not even saying Al Carlson is bad. It's kind of the way human nature tends to work. But it doesn't serve democracy. And we really need to have government of the people.
You were one of the activists behind the formation of the Ethics Commission, and that was something that the legislature resisted for many sessions, but is now part of the makeup of the government. That said, it's still looking, I think, to get some traction as well. And yet, this bill that you listened to this morning would exempt the actual map drawing, as I understand it, from open records law while they're creating these districts, these new districts. Why would that be the case?
Well, your guess is as good as mine, Doug, but we and the Newspaper Association and North Dakota Native Vote and League of Women Voters are all very, very concerned about that. You can't possibly have participation in the process if you are not privy to the current thinking of the group. So we will be very proactively looking for the widest possible opening of that process. We expect to have people, private citizens, maybe we're considering asking some faculty members in geography to work with us on the side so that we can bring some very viable alternatives to the table. But if we don't know what they're working on, then we can't work together. So this is a public function that greatly impacts democracy and representation in North Dakota. Basically, what happens when you're gerrymandered, that means your vote doesn't count as much as the other one. So if you're in the minority in a gerrymandered district, you don't even need to vote because it's been rigged for whoever's favored. But I do want to emphasize, by the way, that both parties gerrymander.
Yes.
It's not a matter of party. It's a matter of power. When you're in power, you want more.
And that's why every 10 years when the census mandates the lines be redrawn, there are stories and proposals for making this more objective because the majority will be quite subjective in terms of how they want to draw the lines. You know, you mentioned software that could, you know, mm-hmm. look through a voter record and basically create districts that would be almost perfect, one would imagine. But that's not the way it's done right now. There was a measure number 3 last year that I suspect you were supportive of that was taken off the ballot, I believe, by the Supreme Court. What would measure number 3 have done to change this process?
Measure number 3 was actually sponsored by North Dakota Voters First. And one of the major policy issues was redistricting. And what it would have done would be to put the Ethics Commission in charge of drawing the districts. The purpose of that was to capitalize on having a clearly independent group to do the work, because the process of choosing the members of the Ethics Commission was bipartisan and very, very seriously undertaken, for looking for people of good judgment and diverse points of view. It could also be any, we chose that rather than try to design another kind of independent group. And, you know, here we just got the Ethics Commission, now we're getting another group and so on. But the main point of it is to be able to have people who don't have a dog in the fight do the work.
You were proposing that the Ethics Commission actually do the work of redistricting as opposed to the legislative committee, and that's not going to happen because that was taken off the ballot and the process is the process now.
Exactly, Doug, and that's why we're working now to try to improve the process. We certainly respect the law and the legislators' prerogatives as it now stands in the law. We just think that they could be more welcoming of both some objective criteria and some input from the public. The other thing we're asking them to do is, before they vote on their final map, that they take a look at the criteria they themselves have put in the bill and 2 or 3 other criteria that are commonly used in other states. And if their proposed final map deviates from any of those, to explain it. So, for example, right now, the town of Stanley is cut in half with districts. Suppose they decided that that was the right way to go next time. One of the criteria is respect city, county, and geographic boundaries to the maximum extent possible. So if they split a city like that, that could have been all in one, they would simply need to say, here's why we did that. So it's just a way of trying to help them be more thoughtful and more accountable. They do that, by the way, in terms of how many people are in each district. They very closely analyze to make sure that the number of people is correct. But they could be doing testing the plan on other dimensions as well, and we'd like them to do that. If they don't, we will.
If the legislature does indeed draw new district lines that, in your mind or the minds of other people in your point of view, violates the intention of the process, is there a way to go to court with this?
Oh, yes. We always have recourse of one way or another. One would simply be to refer the map. I'm assuming that could be done. It'll be an act of the legislature. We haven't looked into it, but yes, that has been done, I believe, in North Dakota over the years. We have quite a spotty history of redistricting going back a long way. Yes, there is recourse. Of course, it's much better if you can work things out together. And that's one of the things that has really been very rewarding about working in the nonpartisan area in the pro-democracy space. So often we actually have fun across different philosophies, because at the end of the day, we all have the same goal. We're all trying to make this a better representative democracy. And we, you know, there's no reason why we can't expand that approach and that collegiality to include the policymakers as well.
Given the state's long-running supermajority, though, isn't most of the gerrymandering already done?
Well, there's no reason they have to start with the way it is now. No reason. In fact, one of their own criteria by law is that districts be compact. And it turns out that's a technical term. It's not just a nice thing. The most compact shape is the circle. And moving out from there, districts more compact. The most compact shapes have a smooth boundary, and the boundary is equal points from the center. So in terms of shapes we're used to, the next most compact shape would be a square. Well, if you take a look at the districts we have now, it's just crazy. They're all over the map. There are jogs in, bumps out, things that look like chimneys coming out. Some of them look like ice cream cones. They're not compact. They're simply not compact. So by their own criterion, they need to be looking at the legitimacy of the map itself and not be thinking that they can just make some adjustments.
Nevertheless, again, given that supermajority of Republicans in the legislature, it would seem that the Republicans will create a redistricting plan that they want. And isn't that likely to further strengthen that party's already stronghold on North Dakota's government?
Here's my maybe a Pollyanna. I've been accused of that. But we really appreciate, Doug, you putting us on your show, because we don't think that's what the people of North Dakota in any party want. We think the people of North Dakota want a responsive government that listens to them. And we think all of us believe that there's room for improvement there. So the more people understand about what's going on and how very important it is in terms of how things will turn out, the more we are hoping they will put pressure on legislators and certainly encourage people to get in touch with them starting now and come to those meetings when they're held in the summer. So I have a really strong belief that that it's possible. But it'll take a lot of work, and some of it won't be a lot of fun. But you're absolutely right. Al Carlson was proud as could be of what they did 10 years ago. And I'm sure there are legislators now who would be equally proud and are just as driven to have that same kind of result. But if we, the people, let them know that we're expecting something better, something that is more respectful of our votes, then maybe they'll open their eyes a bit.
Ellen Chafee is a board member with North Dakota Voters First. You can find out more about the issues and the position of North Dakota Voters First at ndvotersfirst.org. Ellen, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, a commentary by Mark Trahant.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, well, I have some questions and I get to ask them along with questions from many of our listeners.
Someone wanted to know, what's the best biography of Abigail Adams, one of the most interesting first ladies in American history? I wanted to talk about the idea that Jefferson was impeached. Actually, he wasn't, after his disastrous governorship in Virginia in 1781. So we got questions from a variety of people on a wonderful set of subjects. This is an out-of-character show in which we try to answer as many questions as we can in the course of an hour.
And we end the conversation talking about Jefferson and his literary pursuits and tastes.
Thomas Ricks has a new book called First Principles about the founders and the classical world, and he has some relatively sharp things to say about Mr. Thomas Jefferson.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
In this unprecedented moment in our history comes yet another historical first. Former President Donald Trump is on trial for a second time in the Senate. You can stream NPR's extensive live coverage at prairiepublic.org or watch the PBS NewsHour's coverage on Prairie Public's World Channel.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a seasoned journalist and editor of Indian Country Today, an online news service that offers a native perspective on current events. He also writes and voices commentaries, and today his subject is the pending confirmation of Interior Secretary nominee Deb Haaland.
President Joe Biden nominated Haaland, Laguna, and James Pueblo to lead the agency that has implemented the relationship between tribes and the federal government since the transfer of Indian Affairs from the Department of War in 1824. And at the same time, the Interior Department is responsible for fish, wildlife, and being the nation's landlord, managing some 640 million acres, more than 30% of the country. That includes a huge portion of natural resources, such as oil and gas. And it's the extractive industry and its allies in Congress that are lining up opposition to Haaland. This weekend, Montana Senator Steve Daines, a Republican, said he would block Haaland's confirmation by the U.S. Senate. Had Democrats lost the election in Georgia, Daines could have done just that. A unified block of Republicans would have been enough to deny her the job. The Senate is equally split between Democrats and Republicans, with Vice President Kamala Harris holding the deciding vote. The chairman of that committee is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. The Democrat said he has talked over Zoom with Haaland, and he prefers to give the administration its own team. No date has been set yet for Haaland's confirmation hearing. On Indian Country Today's newscast last week, Holly Cook Macaro, Red Lake Ojibwe, and a partner with Spirit Rock Consulting, said the reason for that opposition is the Biden administration's climate change framework. Macaro said that when Representative Pete Stauber, our Minnesota, and several of his colleagues in the House called for Biden to withdraw Haaland's nomination, there was an immediate response from tribes. The tribes in Minnesota and the region pushed back immediately, which I thought was a terrific warning shot for the rest of the industry and the country that she has a solid base of support, Macaro said. That could be said in Montana, too. Despite Daines and Representative Matt Rosendale's opposition to Haaland, tribes not only continue to support Haaland for the post, they are also on record opposing the Keystone XL pipeline. Keaton Sunchild, Western Native Voice political director, tweeted, "For the indigenous people of Montana, this will be the first time we will have representation in a high-ranked position at the federal level. We hope that Senator Daines will reach out to all Montanans and reconsider his position. I encourage everyone to reach out to Senator Daines' office and tell him to support this historic nomination." I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, A Postcard from the Prairie by Eliza Blue, and Main Street Eats with Sue Malcolm. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Researchers say while vaccines will help tamp down COVID-19, the widespread nature of the virus could be endemic, meaning it's something we'll have to live with. They say they expect COVID-19 to behave like some strains of the flu. Dr. Greg Poland is a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Mayo Clinic.
I think most of us that look at these data and think about these things are in agreement that if we had to place our money, This is a virus that's going to be with us for a very long time.
Poland says we should get back to a more normal life, even with the virus staying around like influenza. The North Dakota House has approved a measure that would prohibit transgender athletes from competing on teams that do not match their birth gender. Supporters of the measure said it's designed to protect girls from having to compete against boys who are physiologically stronger and faster than girls. Ledgerwood Republican Representative Kathy Scrow is the lead sponsor.
This is about girls competing with girls, ensuring equal opportunity, and keeping a level playing field in girls' sports. It upholds 50 years of progress in protecting women against discrimination and advocates for the preservation of the biological-based standards for female sports competition.
Opponents said LGBTQ kids are often bullied at rates much higher than other kids. House Minority Leader Josh Boshay of Fargo said the suicide rate among those kids is very high.
This is telling kids who just want to participate in their school, they just want to be active in their community. They're not there to hurt anyone. High school athletics, junior high athletics, it's about participation. It's about learning about yourself, being a part of a team, solving problems, figuring out life. But we're going to tell some kids you can't. And even though most of those kids aren't going to go out for high school athletics because it's not within their skill set or their desirability, they're going to see the action made by this body, and it's going to play into unfortunate other decisions that they won't make.
The measure passed 65 to 27. It will now go to the Senate. And the North Dakota North Broadway Bridge that links Fargo with rural Clay County has been closed to traffic and pedestrians indefinitely after a routine inspection found a tilt to one of the piers of the approximately 30-year-old bridge. City engineer Jeremy Gordon says it's not an immediate threat, but the closure is a precaution.
Evidently, the design wasn't all that great to begin with. So on the north pier, the pier is the thing that the bridge rests on. It sits on pile, but the embankment has pushed horizontally on the pile so that it's tipping. It's not tipping to the point where it's going to fall over tomorrow, but there's enough pressure on that pier that we're not comfortable leaving people on it.
Traffic will be detoured to the County Road 20 Bridge along 40th Avenue North, about a half mile northwest of the North Broadway Bridge. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, Bismarck Republican Senator Nicole Poolman will discuss her assessment of the big issues this session, including bonding and funding for K-12 and higher education, as well as her assessment of this unusual legislative session. Legislative Review is 6:30 p.m. Central Time Friday on Prairie Public's radio and digital platform.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Eliza Blue is a South Dakota rancher who calls herself a shepherd, writer, and folk singer. She's the creator of Postcards from the Prairie. And today's postcard tells the story of her transition from a very different past to where she is today.
Ten years ago this month, I left Minneapolis, enrolled into a tiny town on the prairie. It was meant to be a temporary adventure, but when I crossed the Missouri River and the landscape abruptly changed to moonscape, I started to cry. I didn't know where I was going, but I knew what I was leaving behind, I was leaving behind forever. I was 32, and the third decade wasn't going much better than the second one had. Just a few years before, on the eve of my 30th birthday, I was living on the coast of Maine. I worked as a cook in a cafe during the day, wrote songs at night, and walked my dogs by the ocean at dawn and dusk, watching the tides roll in and out. My tiny studio apartment had a postage stamp-sized yard, and I woke one morning to find a giant hawk perched on the ledge of the garden gate. It was tearing a small songbird apart. "This does not seem like a great omen," I thought grimly. In truth, I already felt a little like the songbird. The circumstances of my life, the giant hawk. But I kept hustling, writing songs, touring, hiring booking agents and managers, until I was making enough money as a musician to pay my rent. Most months, anyway. For every success that glittered and jangled during that time, however, there was a much louder howling that never ceased. I was not where I was supposed to be, and I knew it. Contrast that with the morning before my 40th birthday, when I heard my livestock guard dog, Ellie, barking her customary warning bark from the front yard of our ranch house. It was the bark reserved for coyotes, coons, and other would-be intruders. Since most of those creatures do their hunting at night, I was surprised and went to the window to investigate. Balanced awkwardly on the telephone pole by the yard fence, perched a giant golden eagle, her curved talons too massive to fit on the pole's narrow top. The kids and the man of the ranch were tucking into plates of pancakes still hot from the skillet, so I slipped through the sliding glass door in my sweater and house shoes to get a closer look. As I approached, the eagle cocked her head to fix me in her gaze, then lifted herself slowly into the air with the heavy beats of her elegant wings. It may sound silly, but I have no doubt she came specifically to visit me, and I also have no doubt what she came to share. "Sister," she told me as she took flight, "you're ready." And she was right. Most days, I still feel like I'm hustling. I try to get a little writing done between chores and mealtimes and reading stories to the kids and vacuuming. I stay up too late answering emails. I bake our bread at midnight. I forget to clean the bathroom for a month at a time. But in the evenings, I go running across the prairie with my dogs so I can get a break from the relentless to-do list. And I watch the bright globe of the sun transmute into bands of color. I get back to the house pink-cheeked and still a little tangled in starshine just in time to empty the dishwasher and start supper. At 29, I felt like a small bird, defenseless and tattered, a victim of circumstances beyond my control. Now, I feel a lot more like that eagle, with wings stretched wide and strong. Circling above, I can see our little town and the pointed peaks of our house. I can see the pasture full of beloved creatures and the rolling prairie tumbling toward the horizon, an endless hillside, an endless song. The only howling I hear these days is the mighty prairie wind, and when I get tired, I let it carry me, smooth and certain, so I'm not too breathless to sing along.
Singer-songwriter Eliza Blue. You can follow her postcards from the prairie at elizablue.net. Next on our show, Main Street Eats.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It seems like Congress can do something one day, but not the same thing the day after. Like the laws about loopholes and nothing else. Are we wrong to think this? Join me and my guest, P. Andrew Torres, as we explore the philosophy behind our legal system and ask, is the law consistent? On the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom because it's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining us and stay warm.
I think we yearn to be inside looking at our seed catalogs, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I have one in front of me at this very moment, and I'm actually doing a couple of exchanges on Facebook with some of my friends. There is apparently another rush to order seeds, so I am very grateful that I did in November, because I have an excess now that I can share with some of my friends who can't find their favorite varieties. So if you have not ordered your seeds yet, you can try. But places like Johnny's and Territorial and those places that cater to people like myself who do this for a living, they've actually stopped filling home gardener orders for a couple weeks until they can get caught up.
When you do order seeds, Sue, and you get those seed packets, what are you looking for?
Oh, first of all, that great big beautiful colored picture on the front.
Yes, that got you to buy it in the first place.
That's exactly right. Although there are seed companies that while their catalogs are colorful, they keep their information on the seed packet to a minimum. But you will find that you have to kind of learn how to read a seed packet and or a seed catalog to be really successful. We talked about chocolate and the fact that you can't grow it here, only near the equator. You do not want to buy chocolate seeds, okay? You're getting taken to the cleaners then. So just keep that in
mind. I always think that when I see a hibiscus for sale at the nursery. I'm like, what are you people going to do with this hibiscus?
Sometimes that stuff is more work than it's not. So if you buy the proper plant for this area, there are little keys in those catalogs and on the back of those seed packets that you should be aware of.
What are the top things that you are looking for on that seed packet? Is this like you want it organic, fair trade certified, or are you more looking at your microclimate for your yard? I know I've got partial sun, for example.
Well, that is very important. The first thing I do is I always buy Safe Seed Pledge seeds from the companies that have taken the Safe Seed Pledge. That way I know I'm not getting any Franken seeds. And I love heirlooms. And so that's the first thing I do is I always check the list of Safe Seed companies. And there's tons of them, probably 300 of them out there. But because we live in zone 4, and actually you're on the eastern half of the state, so you might be a little bit less than 4. We're 4A or something like that because we get a lot of warm weather from Montana that kind of circles around here. Days to maturity, really, really important. We have probably a short window of 80 days of really good weather to grow. So you always want to look and make sure that your vegetables will produce within an 80-day or less time frame. Otherwise, you'll be out there with your smudge pots in November trying to get them to
have one
grow.
Of these artificial lights. I got a heating plate underneath it.
A little, what are those little hot water bottles or those little things that people used to have to plug in? And then one thing, if you're going to plant them yourself, you know, like if you're going to start peppers or something indoors, you'll want to kind of like take note on the back of the seed packet, the days to germination. So you don't give up if something doesn't pop out of the ground in 3 days. Tomatoes, oh, they'll come up overnight sometimes. So will cucumbers. But peppers take almost 10 days to germinate. And you need to keep them warm, of course, and they will germinate a little bit faster than if you leave that soil cold and wet. So I would put if I was starting seeds, I would put them in my oven with the oven light on. However, you don't ever want to try baking anything without opening your oven first because you could lose like 49 pepper plants. It's just because you thought that you know, it was going to be okay. I have a double oven and I use the top oven and I had plants in the lower oven and boom, they didn't survive that. So I was pretty disappointed in myself.
And then what about the physical planting of the seed?
Well, first of all, like one more thing that you want to take note of when you're the back of the seed packet will also tell you how many weeks before you can put them in the ground. That you want to, you don't want to start like, oh, it's so tempting. I mean, God, I'm fondling seed packets every day thinking, oh, can I put something in the ground yet? But what happens is they become too large to manage. Last year, I had transplanted my little tomato plants 3 times to keep putting them in larger pots and larger pots and larger pots. And then they become too heavy to tote around and harden off, and it's not worth it. So check the back of the seed packet. Keep in mind that North Dakota will have a freeze, more likely than not, before the middle of May. So you want to count back from about the 17th of May, you know, 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and it'll say start plants indoors 8 weeks before last frost, because that way they'll be manageable. And I know people in April when it's beautiful, or I think last year it was beautiful in March. And I saw all these people on Facebook and they're planting their tomato plants and I'm just laughing. And I said, please, you're not going to make it. You're going to have to cover them up. You're going to have to babysit them. It's not worth it. They will not grow faster or produce more if you put them in the ground too soon. So you want to wait until it's time after that frost in order to plant those plants, because a lot of those people lost all their plants. And that was good for me because I had extras. I sold a lot of my extra plants last year because people froze off early. So now here's something that I learned a long, long time ago, like in the 80s when I used to read organic gardening like it was the Bible. And it said in there that there was a something called the French intensive method of planting. Now, that is something that you can research. They kind of scatter seeds and they plant real thick. But one of the things that came out of that article was the fact that, think about this. If you can plant a radish 3 inches from the next radish and so on and so forth, why does it have to be 24 inches away from the next row? That is a fallacy. If it's 3 inches apart in the row, and let's say if you're working with raised bed gardening, you only have to plant those 3 inches apart from the one next to it because it will still grow and have plenty of space. I think the only reason they say that you have to plant them so far apart is so you can walk between them. But if you're very careful and you can reach across two or three rows, plant them a little closer together when you do put them out in the garden.
Sue, I like what you said at the beginning of the conversation where you were talking about doing a seed exchange. Because, of course, like if everybody buys tomato and pepper and squash and watermelon and cucumber and, you know, and everything, then they're going to have a ton of excess seeds. And so I know a lot of neighbor groups say, OK, I'm going to get tomatoes, you get cucumbers and we'll share seeds and whatever. But I'm wondering, for you, as someone who is very successful at gardening, do you do some seed saving as well as buying new seed every year?
I do seed saving. However, it is a pretty specialized sort of thing because you have to make sure that, like, I love growing peppers, and so I just plaster this one high tunnel just full of every variety of pepper. They do have a tendency to cross-pollinate, and of course none of your vegetables that are hybrid, like Early Girls and those kinds of tomatoes that you'll normally find at a garden outlet store, they won't produce again the next year. They're just not capable of doing that. And so I do save a lot of pepper seeds. And, you know, if you go to the farmer's market and you buy some of those dried chilies and use them for pickling, those seeds in there are perfectly viable if they're grown from a heirloom, non-hybrid sort of plant. Now, the thing is that they do cross with the sweet pepper next to them. They might produce a sweet pepper versus a hot pepper. You don't know which of the genes is dominant. So if you're going to save seeds, you'll want to isolate a variety. You know, your squash. One year I planted a whole bunch of different varieties of squash and came up with one that everybody loved, and we had thousands of them. We gave them away at our open house, but I don't think it was reproducible. I mean, we couldn't figure out which two plants the bees were pollinating from. You know, it was a great color and a great flavor. But yeah, it's something that you have to research very carefully to make sure that you have success the next year. And it's worth doing that because the price of seeds has been exponentially growing, just like my tomato plants.
Sue, I've always wondered, when you buy a seed packet, is it sold by weight or by the number of seeds in the packet? How is that figured out? Because some seeds are just tiny.
Oh, my gosh.
And you wouldn't even be able to count them.
Stevia seeds are the size of a tip of a pencil lead. It's amazing how they can actually get those put into a packet, much less get them out of there and into the soil. That's a difficult chore, too. My friends down in Fullerton that grow seed for Prairie Road Organic Seed Company, I asked her about that. I said, which one of you actually sits down and counts out 25 pepper seeds and puts them in the pack? And Teresa just laughed at me and she said, what we do is we count them out, then we weigh them, and then we scoop them with a spoon kind of into the packages. Now, I'm the kind of person that when I buy a package of seeds that says 25 seeds, I count them. I want to make sure if I'm paying $3.95 for those seeds, there better be 25 seeds in there. Now, I can also buy them by the ounce because I have greater capacity for growing than most household gardeners. So most of the household gardeners would buy seeds if they said 25 seeds in a pack, which is pretty standard. However, you must look at the germination rate also. It says on the back whether those seeds are 99% germination or 75% germination, because if you have 10 seeds, and I'm going to do easy math here because I suck at math. If you have 10 seeds in a packet at 50% germination rate, only 5 of them are going to come up. So if you're planting a garden, you have to look at that, or you're not going to end up with enough plants to fill all your rows. Very important thing to know. If you do save seed, you can check your germination rate quite easily. Like, I think we did this when we were in the fourth or fifth grade at school, maybe even the third grade nowadays, where you wet a paper towel and you put 10 seeds in there, like 10 squash seeds or 10 apple seeds. If 5 of them come up, your seeds are going to be at 50% germination that you saved from the year before. And that is a good way to test whether or not they'll actually germinate for you. I personally don't care what comes out of the ground pepper-wise or tomato-wise, as long as it grows and tastes good. I don't care what the name of it is, you know. It's like, grow! That's all I care about is growing.
So if you have a seed that doesn't germinate and they've got a row where, you know, half or more of them do, is what you do then just plant another seed in that place that didn't germinate?
Absolutely. You can do something called succession seeding. And so a lot of times, you know, if you plant beets early in the spring and then wait 2 weeks and plant some more beets, that way you'll be insured of a crop of nice young beets for the fall for many weeks. But it takes some planning and you have to keep good records. So I always recommend doing a diary thing there. One of the gals I know that grows lettuce for the farmer's market, she actually starts her lettuce indoors also to ensure that when she fills out a row, she has a plant in every space in that row, rather than trust that the seeds that aren't going to come up will leave big gaps in that row.
So do we assume that you won't be planting anything outside until after the middle of May and that you're starting to plant inside in the middle of March?
Correct. I'm going to try to hold off as much as I can, but it's really hard. So I am looking at some herbs because I can always grow herbs and leave them on my windowsill for a lot longer than in the garden. But now I'm asking my husband if he won't dig up a special herb plot for me. And he's just kind of giving me that lazy eye look, you know. It's like, or evil eye look. I guess it depends on how you look at it. But it is tempting. It's so tempting to start now. But I would say, yes, the middle of March, according to my grandmother, is the perfect time to start tomatoes and peppers. You can also start cabbages, and then you can start cucumbers and squash a little later on. But I have those high tunnels, and they'll warm up a lot faster than people's gardens will. So I just might go ahead this weekend and try to plant some peppers, you know, just for fun.
Okay. Well, keep your fingers crossed. We check in with Sue Belcom for Main Street Eats every Thursday. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you guys so much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 11th.
Authorities took only 2 days to close a case of bank robbery that occurred on this date in 1931. 23-year-old mechanic Otto Kruger, who confessed to the holdup, robbed the first German state bank in Fredonia, North Dakota. He entered the bank on a Wednesday as it was closing for the noon lunch hour. After conversation with two cashiers, he brandished a revolver and locked the employees in the bank vault. Kruger took $665 available on the counter and drove from Fredonia to Ashley in his 1928 Buick. The bank employees got out of the vault by working the combination from the inside. Some Ashley residents saw Kruger on the road and soon learned of the holdup. They notified the city constable, who went to Kruger's room in the boarding house and questioned him. The robber's license plate had also been observed, and that, too, led the authorities to Kruger. He was arrested 3 hours after the holdup. A prosecutor and two sheriffs interrogated Kruger at the Ashley jail. They obtained his confession and then jailed him in Napoleon. He was charged with first-degree bank robbery. All but $5 of the loot was found under Kruger's mattress. The gun was found in his room, along with the cap he wore during the robbery. The bank cashiers identified him as the robber. He confessed that he did the holdup to make up for several $100 worth of bad checks he had written. 2 days after the holdup, Kruger pleaded guilty before a Logan County judge. When asked if he had anything to say, he just shook his head. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison and was taken the next day to the state penitentiary in Bismarck. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Biden administration is trying to make sense of a massive cyber hack by Russia. It continued undetected for months.
That was an egregious attack on our government and also in the private sector. It exposed vulnerabilities that, frankly, we should have known we had.
President Biden's early efforts to beef up cybersecurity on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. On our show Friday, we'll preview Sunday's Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein will examine the question, is the law consistent? News director Dave Thompson will recap the week's big stories for us, and Matt Olean will review another new movie, The Little Things. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.